comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. You know what, ladies and gentlemen, this is talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, and we do have some important stuff to talk about tonight. We, tonight, are having a free night here at the Kevin Smith Show. And the free night at the Kevin Smith Show means that you can watch the show for free tonight. Normally, watching the show is something you have to do in the members area, but tonight you get to watch for free. Anybody can watch the show tonight, and if that's what you want to do, if you want to see the show, you just go over to kevinsmithshow.com, my website, and click the link that says Watch Free Tonight. Okay? Remember the K-Files. The K-Files are very important. It's our free weekly newsletter, and we'd like for you to be getting it, and you, I think, would be very pleased to be getting it. It's free, absolutely free. To get it, you just go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, click where it says K-Files, and subscribe. You get a confirmation email, and there's a link in that email for you to use to activate your subscription. If you don't activate it, you won't get it. Okay? Let me ask you a question. Have you ever really thought about the origins of our species? Where did we come from? Well, some people just accept the answer that's handed down to them by Darwinistic scientists and philosophers. Others just accept the answer handed down to them by various religions. But there are some folks who decide to go in search for the answers themselves. That's what my guest tonight has done. And we are going to be able to talk with him. We're going to hear the result of his research, and we're going to be able to talk with him and ask him some questions about the result of his research. It's interesting that his research really got kicked off by his asking two Nobel laureates their opinion, and the answers that each of them gave him spurred him on in his research. His name is Marshall Klarfeld, and on the other side of this upcoming break, we're going to have the opportunity to talk with him, and we're going to have the opportunity to hear the result of his research. I have read his book, and I find it very well done, very well done. It's called Adam, the Missing Link, and we'll be talking about that and the content, the result of his research. Do you have a question about it? If not, we hope this show causes you to have a question. And then we hope you'll give us a call and talk to Marshall. We'll be back. Upon graduating from Caltech back in 1951, Marshall Klarfeld began a 30-year career with Wallace J.S. Johnson's company. It was called Upright Incorporated, and in 1963, Wallace Johnson was elected as mayor of Berkeley, California. So Klarfeld became Mayor Johnson's aide-de-camp, And this partnership produced two national political campaigns, including in 1968, a presidential campaign, and the New Hampshire presidential primary in 1976. After all of that, Marshall Klarfeld had lingering questions about man's origins, and it persuaded him to pursue something that he had been interested in as an undergraduate at Caltech. Uncertain really about how to unravel his questions, he asked his Nobel laureate professors, Linus Pauling and Richard Feynman, for help. Their answers were rather amazing, and they started him on decades of research and then writing of a book called Adam, the Missing Link. Marshall Klarfeld, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Oh, thank you, Kevin. That was a beautiful introduction.
Well, I'll tell you something, Marshall. We are delighted to have you here. I have read your book, and thank you for sending me the electronic copy of it. I have read it. It is fascinating, and I would say very, very well done.
Thank you, sir.
Let's begin with why. I mean, quite obviously, your expertise, in your career, is in business and politics. Why were you interested in the question of the origins of man?
Well, I was a student of the Bible, Kevin, back in college, and I read almost all of it, and some of the stories were fascinating to me and kind of raised very, very many questions. One of them was, how did Noah get all those animals on that boat? You know, that kind of threw me. And I wanted to know why Moses had horns when he came down with the tablets. There were questions like that, and also I was being introduced by the science environment I was in to the origin of our solar system and the universe. And I saw that in the Bible. I saw the Bible had scientific information that we just discovered 100 years ago. And I wondered, you know, how did those guys have that information? And that started me on my quest. And as I researched and researched, I finally discovered the wonderful works of Zachariah Sitchin. And as I read through his 15 books, they're very hard to read, but I found what I thought was, to me, a very plausible solution, and I wanted to share it with as many people as possible. So I created my book, which you handsomely described as Adam the Missing Link. It's in an 8.5 by 11 format. You couldn't tell that from the ebook. But 8.5 by 11 is kind of like Life magazine.
Yeah.
It has 145 pictures in it of the information that I found in my research. And I put it all together and connected the dots, and then I say to the folks who buy my book, make up your own mind. Here are the facts that my research has led me to discover, and I'm a reporter. I'm telling you what's out there. This is information that preceded the Bible by thousands and thousands of years. In other words, the Bible is a window into the history of man about 5,800 years ago. My book is a window into the history of man going back 450,000 years.
Now, in your search for the answers to the questions about our origins, what were your major sources? You mentioned Zachariah Sitchin. Were there others?
Yes. In my early days, as I told you, was an undergraduate at Caltech, and two of my professors were future Nobel laureates. Linus Pauling was the only Nobel laureate to win two prizes by himself, and he was my chemistry professor. And Richard Feynman was the Einstein of my generation. I'm a bit older than you are, but that's okay. And I asked Dr. Pauling if he believed in God, and I asked Richard Feynman if he believed in UFOs. And their answers are in my book. In other words, I remembered exactly what they told me all those years, and I put it down in the book for people to get the scientific answer. In other words, there's this kind of this conflict that goes on in our society between the science, religion, and common knowledge. The information that I found appears in what's called cuneiform tablets. There are over 300,000 of these clay tablets which turned to stone. They were found in the libraries of the ancient rich kings that lived in the Mesopotamia area, which is now Iraq, between the Tigris and Euphrates Valley. And the Sumerian civilization, my research led me to find, were the first ones to start writing down the history of what was going on. And this was thousands of years before the Bible was written. So I wanted to find out if the translation of the cuneiform language was accurate by Sitchin. So I researched five other authors that also did the translations, and I found that they were remarkably similar. However, I think Sitchin did a more thorough job in his interpreting the cosmology of what was going on. These folks wrote, and when I say these folks, I'm talking about extraterrestrials that were here 450,000 years ago and kind of occupied and conquered our, didn't conquer, but just took over our planet. And they wrote in a very interesting kind of, I call it poetry. It's a lyrical form of writing, and the translation shows, now I don't know if they spoke that way, but they wrote that way. And then I found in history in my research that other great authors, Greek authors like Homer, used the same system. They wrote in poetry, and I think they were emulating what these tablets said. And like I say, this is a really robust bit of information that is contained in the, let's say, the 2,000 tablets that Zechariah said were important.
All right, that brings up a question and an issue, and I think this is a good place for us to discuss it, a good place for us to clarify.
Yes, sir.
Sitchin's work has, especially in the last few years, of course he has passed on now, but in the last few years his work has come under attack from such folks as Dr. Michael Heiser, who is himself a professor of ancient languages, one of them not being Sumerian.
Yes.
He says that Sitchin just made up these translations and that they don't say what he says they said. You tell us that you looked at five other writers who translated from the Sumerian and that they were remarkably similar to Sitchin. So how would you deal with that? I mean, here we've got,
okay, well, the answer, I think, in most people's minds is that the scientific community tells us some things, and we're not always certain that what they're telling us is accurate. And I love Carl Sagan. Are you familiar with Carl Sagan?
Oh, yes.
He had a series of TV programs called The Cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
And in his writings, he said, I've developed what's called the baloney detection kit. And the baloney detection kit was Carl Sagan's way of taking scientific information and testing it. And as he tested it, he said, it's either going to be true or it's going to be false, and wherever it leads me, I don't care because I'm after the truth. I'm kind of that way.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of things that are publicly published and people who take Sitchin to task, and I say, okay, you're entitled to do that. We live in a society where you can criticize anything you want. But I think if an intelligent person like yourself were to read all of Sitchin's works, as I did,
mm-hmm.
and gather the other information of the physical facts that are here on our planet. In other words, in my book, there's a page that I show 14 pictures of what is kind of unexplainable stuff, like the pyramids in Cairo,
mm-hmm.
and the pyramids in the Mesoamerica, the Easter Island statues, the cuneiform tablets, the cylinder seals. So there's a subject that nobody really kind of brings up, but to me, the cylinder seals are one of the most clever inventions that I've ever come across. It's a storage information device made out of stone. The cylinder seal is about an inch and a half tall and maybe a half inch in diameter. It's made out of a hardest stone that you can think of. It's called hematite. And hematite has a hardness on the Mohs scale equal to steel. And engraved around the surface, the polished surface cylinder of this little seal are images in a negative. And when you roll this cylinder seal on wet clay, like you would a rolling pin, a positive picture story appears. Now, that's lasted for thousands and thousands of years, Kevin. And it's kind of like a, I call it a stored information device, which is passing to us information that we didn't know, but we should know, and we learned later on. And I refer people in my book to one particular cylinder seal that's in the German Museum. It's a VA-243. And VA-243 shows three figures, human-looking, a plow-like device, and up in the left-hand corner, there is a depiction of our solar system. And this is like, you know, many thousands of years old, but it shows more than just the five planets that you could see around 1600 in our Galileo story. But it shows all nine of the planets plus another planet, which is their home planet, and they called it Nibiru. And according to Sitchin's cosmology, Nibiru entered our solar system in the early stages and came in clockwise. It was captured. It was a free-floating planet, probably been expelled from the explosion of another star system. And it goes clockwise through our system, and it's on an elliptical orbit of 3,600 years. So it comes through by our sun every 3,600 years. Now, the history of that event has been recorded. It's not only recorded by the Greeks, who called it Nemesis, but it's been recorded by the Hebrews, by the Sumerians, by the Arcadians. In other words, during the history of before the Bible, there are folks that have seen it and recorded it. And I said, well, you know, there's kind of some information that you should put together with the Sitchin thesis, which I've done in the book. The book, to me, is a reporter's evidence of what I found, and I just present it in a fashion, as you read it, that people can make up their own minds what it says, what the facts are. You know, who built the pyramids? Who did Easter Island? Who made the crystal skull, Mitchell Pesce's crystal skull? Things like that, which our scientific community can't really explain.
All right, well, I want to, before we get too far afield from my last question, I want to nail this down about the five other sources. You didn't rely entirely on Sitchin. You looked at five other sources that had translated, right?
Sumerian, the language Sumerian, and you say, who are the translators? And I can't give you the names of all of them off the top of my head right now, but I went to their works. And particularly in the, there's one story called the Epic of Gilgamesh, which appeared on 12 cuneiform tablets.
Mm-hmm.
And it was translated by these folks. And the translation is almost, you know, close to what Sitchin says it says. In fact, the 11th tablet of the story of Gilgamesh is the story of the flood. And that translates into what the Noah story is in the Bible. And I don't think anybody disagrees with the translation of the 11th tablet of Gilgamesh, and that's cuneiform. And the interesting thing about cuneiform, according to my research, is it's a language that's no longer spoken, of course. It is very complex. Words can mean five different things, Kevin. So you have to kind of know what you're reading in order to understand what they're saying. And I admire Sitchin for his tenacity to educate himself in the cuneiform language, something I haven't done. But I believe that the translations that he's presented in his books make sense. In other words, they verify stories in the Bible, and they verify the scientific information. And to me, the most important thing is I wanted to know where our species, Homo sapiens, came from.
Mm-hmm.
You see, if you're an evolutionist, you look at the species directly in front of us, or before us, which is called Homo erectus. And Homo erectus, everybody agrees, was a creature, really. It looked like it was human, but it really wasn't, because it couldn't speak, it didn't have the vocal equipment, and it had a brain about a third the size of ours. And it existed on our planet for 1,800,000 years. And the most advanced it was able to evolve to, as far as tool-making went, were spears and stones. Now, 250,000 years ago are the first skeletal remains found of our species, Homo sapiens, in Southeast Africa. And this new species is supposed to be, you know, evolved from Homo erectus, but there have never been found any of the skeletal remains of the transition, the evolutionary transition that should have taken place to produce our species, Homo sapiens. And the most remarkable thing, Kevin, about our species is that in the short evolutionary scale of time, 250,000 years, we've gone from a beginning to a space-age species walking on the moon in 1969. And that, to me, as a educated person from Caltech, needed an explanation. It just doesn't happen that way. So that led me back. And as I did kind of reverse engineering, and was looking for the answers of how we came to be. How did, in the Bible, it says God created Adam in his image. And interesting enough, the cover of my book shows the Sistine Chapel centerpiece, which is Michelangelo's depiction of God with his finger outstretched to Adam. Now, Michelangelo was a great student of the Bible, and the Bible says that God created Adam in his image. So Michelangelo painted Adam, and then he painted God, and God is depicted in the Sistine Chapel as a Homo sapien.
All right, Marshall, we're going to have to step away for a break. It's are just a few seconds away from that. We will pick up right there when we come back. And ladies and gentlemen, if you have the opportunity during this break, click on Marshall's picture on my site. It'll take you to the site with his book. We'll be back. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Marshall Klarfeld. And Marshall, I had to cut you off in mid-sentence there as the break took over. I want to give you the opportunity to complete your thought.
Okay. I was saying that the reason that I believe what Sitchin wrote was an accurate translation of the cuneiform tablets is that there's a large body of evidence to support what he said. And my book was kind of a research project on my own to prove that what he was writing had some validity to it, because it had to be supported by physical evidence. And I present 14 pieces of physical evidence that show that the story is substantiated. And in my book, I present the 14 pieces, and I talk about them individually. I show pictures of what they are. I use my engineering background to analyze the construction possibilities of things. And it all adds up, Kevin. There's just irrefutable evidence of some extraterrestrial influence in the construction of those objects.
Now, you mentioned a particular seal just a moment ago. And the clay, the impression it would make in clay when you roll it out, shows the solar system and so forth. Now, for those who are watching on our television channel, they got to see that. I put it up on the screen.
Oh, wonderful! That's now, great. Now,
one of the things about it, I mean, we always talk about that solar system, but one of the things that's very interesting about that seal is we have a representation of supposedly, allegedly, an Anunnaki who is seated. And then we have two humans that are coming to talk with the Anunnaki.
Well, I think there are two Anunnakis in it, and the third one is a human. You can tell Anunnakis by their headdress. Their headdress has horns on it.
Yeah. All right. Now, the one that's seated, when we compare him to the human that's standing, this guy, this Anunnaki, is a minimum of 7 feet tall and maybe taller.
Yes. They were a large species. They were, you know, the Bible tells the story of the in Genesis 6:4. If you people want to look at 6:4 in Genesis in the Bible, it says the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, the men of renown. And the Bible tells the story of some of these large heroes who lived quite extensively.
Now, Sitchin equates the Anunnaki, Anunnaki being the Sumerian name, he equates that with Nephilim, in that's the Hebrew name, he says. And he says that the translation of Anunnaki would be they who from heaven came down.
Yes.
And he says that Nephilim means those who from heaven came down.
Yes.
Now, this is one place where I do disagree with Sitchin. And the reason I disagree with him is because Anunnaki means children or family of An or Anu.
Yes.
Okay? So it doesn't mean those who from heaven came down. Even today in the Illyrian language and the Illyrian family of languages, putting an I or a double I at the end of a word is how you pluralize the word. So in that family of languages, I am Smith, and all of my children are the Smithy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Hebrew, the way you pluralize it is to put an I-M on the end of it, and it's pronounced Im. So instead of E, it's Im.
Mm-hmm.
So it, yeah. Instead of, in with the Hebrew form, instead of it being the Smiths or the Smithy, it would be the Smithim. And so I've looked for where this thing about they who from heaven came down, I've looked for it in the languages. I don't see it. I see only that it's the pluralization of the name Anu or Nephil. And then it becomes Anunnaki or Nephilim.
Kevin, is it really important what they called themselves or what the Sumerians called them? The important thing to me...
Well, it is. If we're going to say that they are gods or extraterrestrials who came here, then yeah, it is important.
Well, let's look at it this way from an engineering point of view. I know that the hematite that the cylinder seal was made out of
mm-hmm.
is harder than steel.
Yeah.
In order to engrave those images in the negative and to tell the story with pictures that give us, you know, images of whoever they were, wasn't available to the local population. That's a technology that I think we would, our civilization would have a difficult time creating these cylinder, recreating the cylinder seals. And the fact that they were done in stone, to me, makes sense because it lasts a long, long time. Stone is going to outlast every computer system that we have. Our information that we pass on to future generations isn't going to last as long as the stone does. So I'm not going to argue with you about what they called themselves and what Sitchin said the Nephilim meant. My direction was, what are we interpreting what was left to us? I mean, this information that is all over our planet and being uncovered yearly is, you know, well, wow, who did that?
Mm-hmm.
How could they do that? How could these early civilizations have had the technology to have?
Well, certainly there are other places in the Sumerian text that talk about the Anunnaki having come here from a planet, Nibiru. And so, I mean, we have indications of and statements in other places in the Sumerian text that tell us that these are people that didn't come from this planet. And actually, in Genesis, we have the exact same thing in the Hebrew language, indications that they did not come from this planet. For instance, the Elohim are referred to as gods. Well, you know, if they're not from here, then they are extraterrestrial. And so, you know, that's not a problem. The importance of what I brought up about these names, Anunnaki and Nephilim, is that a lot of people, when they start looking at this and they start doing their own research, if they discover this, and it is brought up, by the way, it is brought up by folks who are experts in ancient languages. So when people are searching and they come across this fact, there is a danger of them throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And they say, oh, okay, then this isn't correct, therefore the rest of it must not be correct.
Well, I think if you take, again, Carl Sagan's The Baloney Detection Kit,
mm-hmm.
you can look at this as the body of evidence that I present in my book is not just the language. The language, Sumerian language, is a very, very unusual language. We've tried to trace it to our other languages, and there really isn't any comparison because of its complexity.
That's correct.
And the images that they were able to leave us on these cylinder seals fills out the story. And there are statues. They've discovered a statue of a Princess Ishtar, you know, life-size statue of a character that's talked about in the Epic of Gilgamesh. She's
mm-hmm.
part of that extraterrestrial species that claimed they came here 450,000 years ago and started mining our gold.
It's interesting, too, that her name is the origin of the name used by the Christian religion for a holiday, Easter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Easter, and
well,
it's
I think her name in Sumerian, Kevin, was Iana.
Mm-hmm.
And Iana, I think in the Babylonian or the Arcadian, I can't remember which, she became Ishtar.
Yeah, and goes by several different names in the several different civilizations.
Right, in the Indian, it's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
What fascinated me was that for 6,000 years, civilized people in all the way up to the Romans, the Greeks, the Romans, and going back to the Sumerians, there were 12 deities that were worshipped by everybody. And they, even though they changed names, their description and characterizations remain the same. I'll give you an example. In the Roman, we have the head deity. His name was Jupiter. In the Greek, his name was Zeus. And he had a brother. They both had brothers. And their brothers were water gods. And in the Roman, the brother was called Neptune. And in the Greek, He was called Poseidon. Now, you go back to the Sumerian story of the two brothers. They were Enlil and Enki. One brother was the commander, Enlil was the commander, and Enki was the water god, his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole story, through the translations, is fascinating to me, that the people who, before they became, mono worshippers,
mm-hmm.
were worshipping 12 different gods who were kind of the same.
All right, now, let's talk about how all this plays into the actual origins of the species that today we call us. What did you find in these ancient texts about how our species came to be?
Okay. It's a story. What we're doing today is called genetic engineering. In other words, our scientists are perfecting the skill of genetically engineering, like Dolly the sheep, and
yeah.
Pets, mm-hmm. and chickens, and all manner of foods are being genetically engineered. And the way it works, as described in the cuneiform tablets, how they created Adam, the first Homo sapien, they say, was they took, finally, they did a lot of experimenting around, it didn't work. But finally what succeeded for them was to take the female egg of the Homo erectus female, scoop out the nucleus, put their DNA in its place, fertilize it, and then implant it into the womb of a extraterrestrial female, Anunnaki female. And what they produced finally was called Adamu, A-D-A-M-U. And there are cylinder seals commemorating that event, and there is text in the cuneiform tablets that described how they did it. I call it genetic engineering, and that our species was jump-started from Homo erectus by genetically engineering a new species, and they tell the story of why they did it and how they did it. And I find that to be worthy of interest, because we're doing it now ourselves. We're going to, you know, except for the laws of this country, some country like China will eventually clone humans.
Well, you know, it may already have been done, and we may just not know about it yet. We have to step away for a break, and we shall return. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Marshall Klarfeld, and we're talking about the content of his research into the origins of you and me. Where did all of us come from? So what's talked about here is genetic engineering, and it goes into more detail than Genesis does, but Genesis talks about it too. Genesis says that the Lord God, which, by the way, folks, if you don't know, Lord is not a religious word. It is a political title, and it means boss. So the boss God creates Adam, and it says he breathed into him the breath of life. And there's all kinds of theology books written about what the breath of life is. I can tell you, based on Genesis, that regardless of what you've read, what the breath of life is, whatever it is, it's genetic. It is genetic. So he puts some kind of genetics into this Adam. By the way, in Hebrew, it's Adama, and it means red man. And so how do I know that? Well, because when it comes time for making Eve in the Genesis account, he takes a rib from Adam. He describes modern surgery. The first thing is he causes a deep sleep anesthesia. He opens his side, So that's an incision. Removes from him a rib and closes up the side. And then from this rib, he builds Eve. Therefore, Eve is 100% the genetics of Adam. He does not breathe into her the breath of life, and yet she is described in many passages in the Bible, and her descendants are described as having this breath of life. It is therefore genetic, at least according to the Bible. So what say you, Marshall Klarfeld?
Okay. That's a very precise interpretation. I went a little bit further in my study of genetic engineering into the fact that every, we'll call them clones that are created, including Dolly and the rest of them, and Adam, I think, also, were sterile. They were not able to reproduce themselves. Clones tend to be infertile. For instance, if you cross a donkey and a horse, you get a mule.
Mm-hmm.
And a mule is a cloned creature that can't reproduce itself,
mm-hmm.
sterile. So that something had to be done to give Eve the ability to reproduce. She had to be altered. And I have my own guesstimation as to what they did to do that, but that's not important. The important thing is that our species, which is so special, to have received the DNA, that we all share the same DNA that came from these extraterrestrials. And in it, I think, was the information that allowed us in the short 250,000-year span to become a space-age species. I mean, that wouldn't happen under Darwin. There's no way that could happen.
You would, under the Darwinist theory, you would have to have several million years of evolution to get there.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about the Darwin theory is that, and I always get a lot of email after I say this. Folks, if you haven't noticed, Darwin's dead. And his theory is just as dead, in that there are no transitional trans species fossils. You can see progression and change within a species line over many years. You can see changes, but a horse is still a horse, and a frog is still a frog. There's no transitional trans species fossils that have ever been found.
Well, the reason I called my book Adam the Missing Link,
mm-hmm.
Kevin, is that I believe that the information that everybody's looking for exists in this process of genetic engineering, that Adam is the missing link. Adam is the product of genetic engineering, and we as a species all share the same DNA.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned something in your book that I mentioned in mine, and that is the 223 genes that have no evolutionary predecessors. Tell us about that.
Right. And the scientific community keeps looking for viruses to explain that. But to me, the explanation, I think with you maybe too, Kevin, is that that's the DNA we got from them.
Well, I think so. And here's the problem with that that theory. The scientists keep trying to say, well, it was a sideway insertion caused by viruses. Well, then that virus is the evolutionary predecessor.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, they can't trace it back to a virus. They can't trace it to an evolutionary predecessor.
That's right. And in the story of the of Noah, the Anunnaki, or the extraterrestrials, described the collection of all the species' DNA and put it in a golden box and stuck it on the ark so that after the flood, they could recreate all those species.
Now, is that in the Sumerian text, or I don't recall seeing that in the biblical text.
Well, it's it's in the translation of the 11th tablet of the Epic of Gilgamesh. Has that story. It also has the story of the secret meeting that the humans weren't told about, that Enlil, the chief god, or the chief Anunnaki, not a god, he was a leader, a lord Enlil, wanted actually to destroy the human race. He said that they were diluting their bloodlines with this intermarriage thing, and that they were very noisy, and that this flood that they knew was coming, the tsunami, was going to be caused by Nibiru's passage close to the sun, and that the ice shelf on the Antarctic would be loosened by heating of the planet, climate warming, and it would fall into the sea, creating a huge tsunami which would sweep over and wipe out all the humans. Now, the Ark, as depicted in my book on the Egyptian temple, was not a boat that floated on top. It was a submersible with a snorkel. There's a picture of it in one of my pages that shows that in order to survive a tidal wave or a tsunami, you had to have a thing that would not float on the surface but be submersible. Another little bit of evidence that you put together when you connect the dots.
That submersible that you're talking about, folks, that is one of the images contained. If you go to the internet and type in Temple at Abydos, Abydos, you'll see pictures of a frieze that was up at the top near the ceiling inside that temple. It shows aircraft. It shows what we would call a UFO. And it shows this thing that looks like a submarine.
Right.
And that's where it's from.
What the guy, Kevin, who was sculpting that was looking at. You know, what is he wasn't making this up in his mind. He obviously had to see something.
Well, you would think so, yes. Yeah.
Those are the kind of little tidbits of information that you have to kind of use your imagination to figure out how that happened.
Well, you know, I've done a little experiment, a little test here on the show before, where I've said, okay, here's what we're going to do. Everybody get a pencil and paper. Now draw me a picture of a flammaflige. Well, you can't do it because you haven't seen one.
Right.
So you have no idea what to draw. If you're going to draw something, you can only draw what you've seen. Now, you can draw variations of it. That's true. You can be creative and inventive in varying it. But you have to see something first that you use as a model. We'll be back after this break, folks. To the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Marshall Klarfeld. Those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm delighted that you are here, and my sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you from the first hour. You've missed a universe of information, but we're glad you're here now, and I think you will be too. Marshall, we were talking about the fact that carving in the temple at Abydos, and I think the temple is called Dendera or something like that. This carving is, it looks like a submarine, and quite obviously, the artist, the one who did the carving, had to have seen something that looked like that. And I was making the point, yes, you can do variations on what you've seen, but you can't just make up something from whole cloth that you've never seen and have no concept of.
That's correct. And on page 7 in my book, I've blown up each of those individual objects, took them out of the ceiling facade, and showed what they look like in large scale so people get a better idea on page 7.
All right. Now, This, according to what you've put in your book, this is a depiction of the actual ark.
The submersible, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, being a submersible, you said it carried the DNA of all of these creatures. Is that contained in any of the Sumerian texts?
I got it from the 11th tablet of Gilgamesh. They tell a story of the secret meeting and then the oath and then how he was instructed to take his family and some of his animals and some of his friends aboard. And just before they sealed the hatch, he was delivered this box which contained the golden capsules of all the DNA of all the species that were on the planet at that time, male and female.
Okay. Now, you're an engineer.
Yes, sir.
You have been the aide-de-camp to the mayor of a major city.
Correct.
You are a graduate of a major university.
California Institute of Technology.
And you have been involved in two presidential campaigns at a high level.
Correct.
And I think not for most of our audience. Most of our audience will have no problem at all with someone with your credentials buying into this story. But there are people new to this genre, new to the information, who are scratching their heads saying, how can someone like that believe all of this?
Well, here's the way I presented it in the book. I was a disbeliever. In fact, the truth be known, I collected the information and wrote the book to disprove Sitchin myself. I'm a tire kicker, Kevin.
Okay.
And when I got done with all the information and produced the book, I said, well, you know, people are going to have to make up their own mind. But as far as I'm concerned, Marshall Klarfeld, the mechanical engineer from Caltech, I'm satisfied this story rings true, that it survives the Carl Sagan baloney detection kit.
Well,
he also said, which I thought was, it's amazing that any moment now around the corner we're going to discover something incredible. Well, we're discovering incredible things all the time, but people have to adjust. And I think if you're familiar with the story of Galileo, the scientific community at that time was the Vatican, and the church said that the Earth was the center of the universe. Everybody accepted that because that's what the scientists of the time told them.
Yeah.
Galileo invented a little telescope and looked up at Jupiter and saw these four moons circulating around Jupiter, and with his friend Copernicus, he wrote a little book, which he published, and the Vatican said, you can't publish that because you're going against what we're saying, and they put him in house arrest for the rest of his life because he had discovered a truth that they were unwilling at that time to accept.
Well, it took them 400 years or so, but they did finally apologize.
Yes, exactly. And it's another thing that's happening, Kevin. I don't know if you're familiar with Monsignor Balducci.
Very familiar.
Okay, well, he's telling everybody that the church's responsibility is for the souls of mankind. We don't care where their bodies came from. So he's setting it up that when this information becomes accepted, that story's not going to ruin the responsibility of that church to protect the souls of humans.
Very well, you know, I'm not an enemy of belief, and there are people who think I am because I say things about the fact that belief is of secondary importance rather than primary importance. Facts and truth are of primary importance, and belief is what people use to fill in the blanks at the end of the evidence, at the end of the data. But whenever it gets into the driver's seat, it's, you know, my children are of great importance to me, and I've got one now that's 7 years old.
Right.
And great importance to me. So important, I don't let him drive the car. So beliefs are important. They are so important, you cannot allow them to drive the car. The facts have to drive the car, and then beliefs, sometimes as new facts are discovered, well, they're not new facts. They're, you know, it's new discoveries of something that is a fact. And as that happens, it has an impact on beliefs. And sometimes people are not willing to change their belief system or alter it in any measure whatsoever. And they get very hostile about it. That's letting beliefs drive the car instead of letting the facts drive. And but then there is a problem. And the problem is, how do you know a fact is a fact?
Mm-hmm. Well, here's what I say to people who ask me those questions. I say there is a reference in the writings, the cuneiform tablets, to a deity that the extraterrestrials paid reverence to. It was called the Creator of All, was their deity. And when the Creator of All spoke about destiny and everything that they followed, they obeyed him. And that story comes out in the 11th tablet of the Epic of Gilgamesh, wherein Enki, the second brother, received a message in his dreams from the Creator of All of how humanity was supposed to be saved. It was the destiny of the Anunnaki to come to this planet and to create humanity, and it's the destiny of humanity to inherit the planet and save it. Now, that was a secret that was not revealed in the Bible story of Noah, but it is in the text of the flood story of Epic of Gilgamesh. And I think the reason we were given this information in this form, which is kind of like transferring information down through the generations and thousands of years of history, is that faith in a deity, and they showed it to their deity, the Creator of All, is something that is mixed with this story, and that it doesn't eliminate the belief in a Creator of All. And I've gone in and out of this paradigm myself. And I've come finally full circle to believing that there is a Creator of All. And I don't worship him. I don't know what he is. I have no idea what their civilization, which may have been millions of years advanced over ours, finally came to the conclusion that there had to be a deity who set up the rules. And they followed those rules. They didn't disobey.
All right, I would like to invite our audience to participate with us here in this conversation. And for those who are watching, the telephone numbers have appeared on your screen. And for those who are listening via radio, computers, mobile devices, tin cans with strings, however you're listening, the telephone number here in the studio is 623-444-5889. In the United States and Canada, we do have a toll-free number, and it is 888-223-4599. If you need to call me toll-free, you may do so. If you are outside of the USA and you are outside of Canada, you can call our main number, 623-444-5889, or because I don't have a toll-free number except for USA and Canada, you can send me a flash message, and you go to my website, scroll down, you see Marshall's picture, and to the right of Marshall's picture, you'll see a link, and that link says flash message, so you may do that and participate in the show. Let's go to the telephone line, and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Rex from Miami.
Hello, Rex.
Hey, I was wondering, since you said you read Zachariah Sitchin and five other people, what I've always wondered is when you take a dead language like the Sumerian, how does anybody figure out what the symbols or the words actually mean when you've got nothing else to compare it against?
Well, that's the genius of people who do translations, Rex. You know, there are code breakers all over the world who've tried to decipher the Egyptian hieroglyphics, and it wasn't until they found the Rosetta Stone that gave them a clue as to what the Egyptians were saying. Well, the same thing exists here with the cuneiform language. It's a very simple wedge that's punched into the clay in different forms, and if you look in my book, I've blown up a picture of what the language looked like, and how they did it, I can't tell you because I'm not a translator, but what I needed to know was what they were saying. What Sitchin was saying, was it close to parallel with other people who were trying to translate this very, very unusual and complex language were saying? And once I was convinced that pretty much they were on the same wavelength as far as what these symbols meant, then you had to interpret what they meant, what the stories meant. And the beauty of Sitchin is that he took seven tablets, which is called the Tablets of Creation, that were written by the Sumerians, and it's called Enuma Elish, and I reproduce it in the book, and I give you his interpretation of what those seven tablets were saying. And I find it interesting that the Bible has the creation of the works of God in 7 days. And it's a fascinating program, Rex. If you have a chance, you know, you go to the Kevin's webpage and you punch my picture and put the cursor right on my face, and it'll take you to my webpage. And there's more information there, and you can look inside the book. There's a little link underneath the picture of the book, and it'll take you inside the book, and you can look at it, and there's a way to acquire it also on that page if you want to.
Okay.
Did I answer your question?
Interesting there. Yeah, that sounds interesting. I'll take a look at that.
Thank you.
Rex, that's a very good question, an excellent question. How do they do it? I'm not really sure how they do it, but we've just had the same thing with the Mayan hieroglyphics. Absolutely undecipherable for a long time, for centuries. And really only in late last century, they began to be able to break that code, and now they can read Mayan. But how they do it, well, it takes very special brains to do that.
Absolutely, Kevin. I agree with you. And it's an excellent example of trying to read what people were saying thousands of years ago in their language or their pictographs. Mayan is all like the Egyptians. It's in pictures. And it's fascinating, once they crack the code, how they got some information.
Rex, thanks for the call.
Okay.
All right, 623-444-5889 is the main number here in the studio. And you can also call us if you need to on the toll-free line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, it's good, Kevin. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hello, Terry.
How are you doing?
Very
much
well,
better,
sir.
I hope.
I'm sorry?
Much better, I hope.
Well, yeah, I'm still among the living.
Yeah, you gave us a scare the other night there.
Well, I appreciate it. Gave me a scare too.
I bet. Yeah, I have a question for your guest. How does he explain? Does he believe that all the races were present in Neanderthal form prior to these aliens doing this genetic upgrade, or were the aliens also have different species, like, you know, color people, Asian people, etc.? How did that happen?
Well, your name is Stan?
Terry.
Terry.
So, Terry. Okay, Terry. I asked that same question to myself, and I pondered on it, and I looked in the translations trying to figure out what happened. What I came to my own conclusion is that the species before us, the Homo erectus species, evolved for 1,800,000 years, and they came out of Africa and they populated all the land masses on the planet Earth. And over a period of time, the best I can tell, some of them mutated because of the different climates they were in. Now, by the way, Adam was sand-colored or red-colored. He was not a Caucasian. He was I wouldn't call him a black person because he wasn't black, but he was red, like Indian red, and the color of the Abzu, which was the dirt or the clay of the African area where he came from. In other words, his parentage, his lineage, came from a Homo erectus female who was maybe sand-colored. And so when you put the Anunnaki DNA in there and combined it with their skin color, which I've got to assume was like ours, Caucasian, the result was, and I reproduce in my book the description they gave of him, and it was blood red was the color of his skin, and there was no hair on his arms like the creature, Homo erectus. So that that first Adam and Eve were done in Southeast Africa, were cloned in Southeast Africa, and they were not like us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the part about Finch, isn't that, you know, kind of throws me, you know, about the Sumerian and the alien part about our existence. Genesis explains it to a satisfactory level towards me, but I haven't gotten to a point where how that could happen, you know, how they did it, you know, if we were just a primitive one-type species.
Well, here's what happens. I think that the cloning process took place in other parts of the planet. In other words, there was a place called the Garden of Eden, which was in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley of Mesopotamia, which was way north of Africa. That was above the equator. In other words, you flip from down in the southern part of Africa up into the Mediterranean. And I think that maybe the species that they were cloning there were perhaps had evolved over 1,800,000 years into a different skin color and a different facial features. That the evolution that took place for millions of years of these early Homo erectus species could have produced the Neanderthals, it could have produced Cro-Magnon. But the cloning that they talk about produced our species, Homo sapiens. And then later on, they produced another upgrade of us called Homo sapiens sapien, and that story is in the Bible, and that's another whole tale of how the species was upgraded by the direct insemination of females, human females, by the Anunnaki themselves creating offspring. They were the heroes of old, the giants, the men of renown, because they were a direct product of blood pollution.
Isn't those the ones that were tried to be destroyed because of that?
Well, all humans, both the class of Homo sapien and Homo sapiens sapiens were the same. They were just human. It's just that the intelligence level of the Homo sapiens sapiens was higher than the Homo sapien because they had a direct DNA transfer from the Anunnaki into the female humans, which already were hybrids. In other words, they were clones. And so the injection of direct DNA into the womb of a human produced the giants of old. For instance, in the story of Troy by Homer, there was a lead character called Achilles. And Achilles' mother claims that she was impregnated by Zeus. That story kind of, you know, Homer says that Achilles was a super warrior because he had the direct bloodline of a human and an Anunnaki lord.
Yeah,
you see,
yeah, just like
stories of that.
Yeah, it sounds like just like in Genesis where, God created Adam, and then on the eighth day he created Adam, you know, which Jesus came from, supposedly from the Bible's point of view. And he was a much upgraded model and very intelligent. I'm still kind of scratching my head on that.
But even in Genesis, Terry, you have to realize okay, everybody hold on just a minute. Everybody hold on just a minute, okay? Terry, even in Genesis, the use of the name Adam is not a name. It's a word that means red man.
Why isn't it describing, you know, a person or whatever, a creation?
Well, yeah, when we say he created Adam and Eve, we use that as though those are names. They are not. They are descriptions. Adam means in English red man.
Yeah. Well, isn't there Adam and then Adam? Isn't that two different things, or two different races?
There were two different races in Genesis. Yes. But when you use Adam, regardless of where or how you use it, it means red man.
Okay. That's all I have. We'll let somebody else get in here. Did you get my coin by any chance?
Your poem?
Yeah.
No.
Oh. Well, hopefully you'll get it.
Okay.
I haven't got it back yet. I haven't sent you one.
All right. All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Terry.
All right, the telephone number is 623-444-5889. If you need to call me toll-free in the USA and Canada, you may do so. And that telephone number is 888-223-4599. If you are outside of the USA and you are outside of Canada, and you don't want to make the international long-distance call, you can send me a flash message and participate that way. All right, to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Oh, my first name is Jen.
Hello, Jen.
I'm calling from Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm.
And I just I had one question and then one comment about the red man also, from a perspective of a friend who's a hypnotherapist, and she did many sessions years ago, and the what she found was that people of our race now had two different memories that were common. One was of being what I call the white invader race, and the other was of being one of the red indigenous people. And she said sometimes someone would have a memory of being one of the red indigenous people and being taken up on the spaceships and whatever the genetic engineering happening, but then the same person would have a memory of being from the white invader race and being on the spaceship. So I'm wondering what the author thinks, if that's possible, that we're all of the above.
Okay, we have a break taking over. We'll have to wait to the other side of the break for the answer. Jen, hang on, and we'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest this evening, Marshall Klarfeld. On the telephone with us is Jen from Santa Fe, and Jen asked the question about people who have been regressed by a hypnotist, revealing that they have memories of being part of the red race here on the planet, and also memories of being part of the extraterrestrial race. And you were just about to answer that, and we got cut off by the break. So, Marshall, the floor is yours.
Yes, thank you, Kevin. And, Jen, I think that hypnotherapy is a very useful tool, and people regressing back to past lives does reveal supporting information to the story that I tell in Adam the Missing Link. So I'd have to agree with you that yes, that is a substantial way to help people through hypnotherapy, but also to reveal this story in a form that is submerged in our subconscious? Very good question, Jen.
Well, I had one more quick, easy question.
All right.
Okay.
Could you tell the audience a little more about what's coming up for you as far as conferences?
Oh, right. Thank you for bringing that up. I'm going to be speaking, Kevin, this Saturday at the Aztec UFO Symposium in Aztec, New Mexico. It's an annual event. This is the 14th year. And apparently, and I didn't know this, but Aztec, New Mexico coincided with Roswell, and that they had some kind of a crash landing there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to find out all about that when I get there. But I'm a guest speaker on Saturday, this Saturday, at that symposium.
Outstanding. Jen, thank you for the call. Very interesting. Let me say for the audience once again our telephone numbers. Those who are watching are seeing the numbers on their screen, and those who are listening, the telephone number here in the studio is 623-444-5889. The toll-free number, 888-223-4599. That works in the USA and Canada. And then if you're not in the USA and you're not in Canada and you wish to ask a question or make a statement, you can either call the main number or you can use the flash message option that's on my website. You just go to my website, scroll down, and you'll see the link that says flash message, okay? Now, if there's a question in your mind or there's a comment that you feel like somebody ought to make and you're thinking about it, you know, it's there for a reason. And we try to think of as many questions as we can. We try to cover as much material as we can. But I just have one brain. And that's why we open the telephone lines for you, okay? So the time to bring it up is right now. Marshall, Zechariah Sitchin wrote what he wrote, and it's all very interesting. I've read it all. It's all very interesting, very compelling.
It's hard to read. I admire you, Kevin, for plowing through his stuff.
But
he didn't write in an easy way.
No, but we know that aside from his writings, actually because of his writings, but in his life, there were a lot of attacks and opposition to what he had written.
Yes.
Now, you knew that before you wrote your book.
Yes.
And I'm curious, now that you've written the book, have you stepped into that same pool of opposition?
No. No, I would say I've had several heroes in my life, my professors, my teachers, Linus Pauling and Richard Feynman, and I rank Zechariah Sitchin as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I admire his work, and I would say that I'm probably a disciple of his.
Okay, but my question is, he was being opposed. Now that you've written a book that deals with a lot of his information, have you begun to experience that same opposition?
No, I've questioned him. I have a 10-year relationship with Sitchin, going back to 2001. And in my correspondence with him and my phone calls with him, I raised most of my serious doubts that came to me, and he answered them satisfactorily.
Yeah, but I'm not questioning that. I'm talking about other people's response to you.
Well, they're entitled to their opinion, Kevin. I mean, it's,
well, I understand. I'm asking, is it happening? Is the opposition that he experienced happening to you?
No. No, I've gotten, in every program I've been on, many of these radio shows,
mm-hmm.
the people call in, and maybe one in five have questions that I try to answer honestly, that they're in opposition to what I'm saying, but I don't challenge their belief or their faith. I tell them that they're entitled to believe whatever they feel comfortable, because I think faith is a good thing. And I'm just a reporter. I'm just telling you what I discovered, and I'm not advocating anything, Kevin. I'm just saying that you asked me, do I personally believe what I wrote? Yeah, I finally came to the conclusion that this probably has more merit than anything else I've discovered in the 65 years I've been researching this thing.
Okay, good enough. To the telephone, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, my name is Charlotte from Kansas.
Okay, say it for us again because it was distorted on the phone line.
Travis from Kansas.
Travis from Kansas. All right, Travis. What's on your mind?
Well, I was wanting to ask the doctor if he thought what Hitler was doing was trying to get rid of the other races and make the white alien races more dominant and just trying to get rid of the red race that was...
Is he breaking up, Kevin?
Yeah, he is. He wants to know, do you think that Hitler trying to get rid of all the races except the white race was, he was trying to clear out everything that was not alien, was not the alien race?
Well, Hitler was just one of many tyrants who tried to do elimination of species, not species, but of... what was going on in Kosovo was ethnic cleansing. That's the word they used, and it's gone on in Africa over and over between the tribes.
Well, it happened in Bosnia, but I want to be very clear. It never happened in Kosovo. That was fiction.
It was?
It was. I was there. I was liaison between the international community and the Serb police, and what you got told in America was a lie. It never happened in Kosovo.
But in history, Kevin, there are examples of similar ethnic cleansing that nothing new. Hitler put a spin on it and carried it to an extreme. But other powerful dictators like Stalin, I think Stalin maybe killed more people than Hitler did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure of that. But.
Well, yeah, I think it's about 20 million of his own people, something like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, clearing out people of a particular ethnic background would not mean that you're making what's left over. Well, let's see. How can I say this? It doesn't matter what ethnic background you decide you're going to clear out. They are as much alien as any other ethnic group, and if what the Sumerians wrote is true, they have the same amount of alien DNA as any other ethnic group.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. People should really understand that. It might be very helpful on the political scene if we all, understood that we share the same DNA and that our origins were what appear to be in the cloning area, and that we should just try to live together and help each other.
Does that answer your question, Travis?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank
you. I had one more quick one.
Yeah, okay.
So there was two races fighting for to get a certain group established on this planet?
You mean two extraterrestrial races fighting to be established here?
Yes.
Well, I don't know. Let's find out.
Well, I don't know either.
Mm-hmm.
But the story, look, I think our planet is, the scientific community calls us the Goldilocks planet because we're just right to support life. We're the right distance from our sun. We've got water. We've got atmosphere. And life thrives here. So there are more than one extraterrestrial species out there. There's millions of them, as far as I can tell. And the ones that come by in our direction, we're just off in the left corner of the Milky Way galaxy, they drop in. Yeah, they want to see what's going on. So this is just one record of one particular extraterrestrial species that that landed here. There have been others, and there seems to be evidence of other extraterrestrials visiting us as a 7-Eleven.
All right. Travis, thank you for the call. We have a flash message now from the United Kingdom. This is from Ross in the UK. And he wants to know, during your research for your book, have you come across any hints or clues as to where humanity on Earth is headed?
Well, that's a good question, Ross. My analysis is that in the 11th tablet of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which I described very thoroughly in my book, their deity, called the Creator of All, said it was destiny that the extraterrestrials called themselves Anunnaki were to come to this planet and to create the human species, us. And it was our destiny, when we were to inherit this planet and given the equipment that was transfused to us through this genetic engineering, it was our responsibility to take care of this planet. And with that, I found that in my research, the word destiny was very, very important to the Anunnaki. They believed that everything ran in cycles, and if the Creator of All told them it was their destiny, then they had to save us. So what happened after the flood was that nobody could survive with the earth covered with many, many feet of mud. Life was impossible for humans, but the reason we survived was that they turned around and helped us. They provided food, and that cylinder seal shows them bringing animal husbandry and the plow, which is how to raise crops, so that we would never made it after the flood of about every civilization has recorded the history of this flood, and it wiped everything out about 11,500 years ago, and the survival was helped or, you know, put forward by the Anunnaki to help humans survive. We couldn't have survived that situation. They could. They had the technology. They had the will, because they were directed to do it by their deity, the Creator of All. And that's my interpretation of how we made it through that calamity. Does that answer your question?
So do you expect that if there is another earth-busting calamity, that they will be here to rescue or to help the survivors?
It depends on who's in charge. Now, this is a question that Sitchin and I batted this back and forth, because I had that same question, Kevin, that I put to him. And he said, Marshall, it depends whether there's warring clans in their society. There was the Enlil clan and there was the Enki clan. And whoever is dominant...
All right, a break's taking over. We'll get back to that when we come back from this break. And the phone lines are open, so you just hang on and we'll get to you after the break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and to my guest, Marshall Clarfield. And Marshall, when we went away for break, I had to cut you off in mid-sentence.
Right. It's interesting about the speculation as to what would happen if these Anunnaki return. You know, their planet supposedly goes on this 3,600-year cycle around the sun, which people are now trying to project when they're coming back. And I go back in history, and I see that the last civilization that recorded the passage of Nibiru were the Greeks. And they called it Nemesis, because the gravitational effects of a body that large coming between Jupiter and Mars causes volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, and all manner of trouble. And I often wondered, Kevin, why the Romans didn't record it, because it, you know, it supposedly came through their civilization. And I did my research, and I said, you know, there's one thing that they did record, the Romans, and they called it the Star of Bethlehem. which occurred around the time of Jesus. And it was in the sky. It was something bright. Everybody's tried to explain what it was. To me, it's possible that it was their observation of Nibiru coming through at that time frame. And if you do the math on it, as I've done many times, it fits that zero was the time of the last passage of Nibiru.
Well, if that's the case, then Nibiru will not... If that's the case, Nibiru is not due back for another 1,500 years or so.
Correct. Yeah. You are correct, sir.
All right, to the telephone caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller. And the caller is not there. All right, 623-444-5889. Toll-free, 888-223-4599. If you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can avail yourself of the flash message option on my website if you so desire. Marshall, if Nibiru is not due back for another 1,500 years or so, that somewhat puts a dent in the prophecies that we're hearing a lot of people talk about, the Mayan prophecies and the end of the calendar.
2012 thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So which one is it?
Well, you know, I think the Mayan calendar, which was a marvelous construct, it reminded me of my slide rule at Caltech. I used to use a slide rule to do math.
Mm-hmm.
The Mayan calendar is two cylinders inside of each other rolling on a stick.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cyclical, and it goes forward and backwards over a million years. It's the most accurate thing that was ever produced, and I'm sure the Mayans didn't produce it. It was given to them by the Anunnaki, and
mm-hmm.
they just followed the cycles. And this is just the end of one cycle and the beginning of another, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, that's my interpretation of it, 2012, December 21st.
So you don't see December the 21st, 2012, as being the date of an Earth Buster?
No.
Do you think Nibiru is close to Earth and approaching Earth now, as many people say it is?
No. I mean, my calculations, we would have seen it. Somebody would have reported it. You know, it takes a long time to make its 3,600-year traverse. And in 1989... there was some scientific excitement about that they discovered the 10th planet with one of their new satellite telescopes, but that kind of died in the vine. The scientific community is not willing to accept this possibility yet. In other words, this is all cosmology that is not really truly accepted by most of the scientific community. That's why I think it's so interesting in my book that I've quoted Richard Feynman on UFOs. If people are interested in what this great man had to say when I asked him if he believes in UFOs, they can find it in my book. And also I asked Linus Pauling, my chemistry professor, if he believed in God, and I reproduced his answer in my book. So if they go to your webpage and click on my picture, it'll take them to my webpage.
And let me say, I found their answers very interesting and very precise. In other words, they were the answers of very scientific minds.
Yeah, now these are guys that, you know, are part of that community, and I was a brazen young undergraduate who cornered them and asked them these questions, and I was amazed at the answer they gave me because it made sense, each one of them. That's why I reproduce it in the book.
Do you think that, for instance, on Feynman, do you think there was something beyond what he told you that he was reserving, that he was holding back?
Yes, yes.
I got that impression from reading it.
Yeah, and it took me a long time to figure that out, Kevin. Finally, when he said, if they survive their space age,
mm-hmm.
that's the key of that answer. If they survive. In other words, every space age seems to have missiles that they can launch into space and atomic weapons. And the combination of atomic weapons and rockets is
mm-hmm.
deadly.
Oh, yes, it's deadly. Yeah.
You have to have a political system that can survive that.
After writing the book, obviously you wrote it because you want people to read it. You want them to know this information.
Yes, sir.
But now you've written it, you've published it, it's available for people to get. After they read what you have written, what is it that you want them to carry away from that?
I want them to decide for themselves where we came from. In other words, we've gotten information from the Bible. We've gotten information from scientific evolutionary theories. I think the school children in this country should be available, have available to them three things to study. They should study evolution, the Bible, and genetic engineering, and then make up their own minds. We can't be telling them what to believe, as the school systems are doing now. I think it's unfair.
One of the things that I have said many, many times, and I think most people, if they will just pause a moment, take a deep breath, and think about this, I think most people would agree, and that is, when it comes to our origins, if you're a Darwinist, that is a belief system. It is a faith. If you believe in creation, as it is told either, well, by any religion, that is a belief system, and it requires faith. If you buy into the genetic engineering, and some people call it ancient astronaut intervention theory, that is a belief system too, and it's a faith. Now, the reason that's important is because sometimes people say, well, you folks believe in something and it's all faith, but mine is not. Mine is fact. Well, the fact is, none of us were there to see it happen.
That's right.
And therefore, whose ever evidence you buy, that's faith. Marshall, we've hit the end of the show. I want to thank you for being here. I think you've written a magnificent book. I enjoyed it.
Well, thank you, Kevin.
And
I hope your readers that are interested will go to my webpage and get a copy of it.
Well, it is, and folks, it is loaded with illustrations, loaded with photographs, and so you get to see what he's talking about as well as read about it. And I found it to be, if it was a paper turned in to me as a college professor, I'd have to give it an A+. It was very well done.
Sure.
Marshall, if you will, stay on the line with me for just a moment. And folks, that's going to do it. That's a wrap for this evening. Be sure you check out Marshall Klarfeld's book, Adam, The Missing Link. You can click his picture on my website, and it will take you to his website with information about the book and some samples as well. My friends call me Steeleye. My enemies do too. And you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.